From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 22 million single women didn't vote in the 2000 presidential election. This time around, both parties are actively seeking their support. They're a diverse voting bloc that includes young professionals, single mothers, and widows. But analysts say they could decide the race. Tonight on Point, why single women have stayed away from polls in the past and what might energize their vote this year. But first, we turn to the latest developments in Najaf. Today, leading Shiite cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani returned to Iraq, and he wasted no time making his presence known to his chief rival Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. Al-Sistani called on all Iraqis to march on Najaf and reclaim the holy city. Scott Baldoff is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. I asked him what impact al-Sistani's return will have on tensions in Najaf.
Well, this may be the last real chance of negotiating a peaceful withdrawal of Muqtada al-Sadr without fighting it out to the very end. Before Sistani made his announcement, it looked like the government was going to go in. They were within about 200 meters of the front door of the shrine. Tanks were very close in. Iraqi forces had been deployed, and that was a clear sign that they intended to try a frontal assault. For quite some time, they've been saying that American forces would not be used, it would be Iraqi forces. So their arrival was an ominous sign. Also ominous was the fact that, you know, a lot of reporters who were going into the old city to see the fighters said that they looked increasingly exhausted, that their numbers had depleted, and that several had apparently left for safer places to be. So it was looking pretty bad. Now with Sistani coming in, perhaps this provides a face-saving way for Muqtada al-Sadr to hand the keys to the shrine over to a higher religious authority rather than to the government, which is something that would be palatable to him, and for his followers, he would still come off looking like a hero.
A face-saving aspect to it there. But one of the things that al-Sistani has called for is this sort of mass march to Najaf. What are some of the implications of that? Is that likely to be something that would encourage a peaceful settlement, or does it have the possibility there of erupting into chaos?
I would have to suggest that any sort of peaceful march there would likely at least stop any forward movement by U.S. troops. They would not want to start a battle where there could be thousands of non-combatants put into harm's way. And so the implications of that are likely peaceful rather than whipping up the crowd.
What does this mean for the sort of clout left to al-Sadr? Is he willing, do you think, to easily hand over the keys to the shrine, do you think? It pretty much sets him up as second player. What aspects of power struggle are going on here between these two clerics?
That is a thing. They are rivals, and Sistani is the senior cleric of the two of them. Muqtada al-Sadr has often seen Sistani as too quiet for a Shiite's own good, that the Shiites need to have somebody who is a little more radical, such as himself. But for him to hand over the keys to a higher religious authority does not necessarily mean that he's going to follow Sistani in everything he suggests from now onward. It is just a chance for Sistani to show once again that he can be a mediator. He played this role back after the uprising in April. He's playing it now, apparently, again, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the Muqtada al-Sadr's movement will now be subsumed underneath Sistani's direction. It just means that they get to live another day.
Last Thursday, Scott, you and a team of reporters were allowed into that shrine in Najaf, and you described the attitude of the people there as being quite upbeat. You've said today that exhausted might better describe their demeanor.
That's right. At the time that we went in, there were still about 2,000 human shields, volunteers, people who were supporters but not combatants, who had come from as far away as perhaps Baghdad, Nasiriyah, and other Shiite cities to throw their support and to try and cheer up the fighters. Their numbers have gone down dramatically to the hundreds, the low hundreds, and a number of the fighters have deserted or left for their own homes because of the possibility of a final battle. So I think it's just a matter of attrition. It was almost inevitable, particularly since most of the residents of the old city have moved out. Now they are forced to rely on whatever trickle of food or water is able to come in or be brought in by supporters who are willing to risk their lives for this. It kind of was inevitable that this would happen.
Is it possible for you to have any sense of how they would view the return of Al-Sistani?
I think that there will be some suspicion by the Sadr forces, because again they view him as somebody who has been perhaps a little too cooperative with the Americans. But on the other hand, it will be one large Shiite cavalcade. I think they'll see him as an ally, certainly more so and more palatable to work with than the government of Ayat Alawi.
And it does appear at this point that he offers them a way out of this standoff.
That's correct.
Scott, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
Scott Baldoff is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to me from Baghdad. You can read Scott Baldoff's latest article on our website. Go to wbur.org. In the U.S., single women are being targeted by both parties as a potent pool of voters. Women make up the majority of undecided voters across the country, and single women represent an even larger untapped group. Tonight on Point, why single women have stayed away from polls in the past, and what might energize their vote this year. Why are 22 million unmarried women not voting? It's a number so large I could barely get it out earlier. Do you think unmarried women could become a political force? Are you a single woman who feels the political process ignores you? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Paige Gardner, co-founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote, and an expert on the voting patterns of women. Good evening, Paige.
Good evening.
Also with us is Susan Carroll, professor of political science and women's and gender studies at Rutgers University. She's a senior scholar at the university's Center for American Women and Politics and the author of Women and American Politics, New Questions, New Directions. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jennifer. Hello to our guest.
Paige, if I can begin with you, the obvious question, why don't single women vote?
Single women don't vote because they don't think people are talking to them. They don't think politicians and elected officials understand their lives. And as in our focus groups, they don't think that politicians and elected officials have walked in their shoes, that they know what it's like to struggle with incomes that need to keep up with rising prices, education costs, healthcare costs, being one crisis away from an economic disaster.
Now, does this have more to do with them being single or more to do with them being female?
It really has to do with both, but primarily unmarried women, single women in this country are like the face of America, except in one critical aspect. Half of the unmarried women in this country make $30,000 or less. So they are really on the edge economically every day.
Okay, and that's a class distinction there more than anything, isn't it?
Well, in part, yes, that's correct.
Can I ask you to just quickly here, because it's out there, there are 19 million single men who didn't vote in the 2000 election. Why is that not as potent a vote, seen as a potent a voting bloc?
Well, it's actually interesting because what we have in this country now is more of a marriage gap than a gender gap. And certainly, you know, unmarried people overall are underrepresented in the electorate. But because unmarried women are the largest group of people who are not participating in our process, who are on the sidelines of democracy, this is a key group that we need to target and we need to bring into the process.
Paige, is it a key market in certain key battleground areas as well?
It's a key market in every state in this country.
Okay.
I mean, what we need to do is reach out to these women and bring them into the political process.
Susan Carroll, I have a history question for you here. Is this this issue of single women not going to the polls, is it a new phenomenon? I seem to remember in the early 90s that women were trooping to the polls.
Actually, it is not a new phenomenon. Women do vote at a higher rate than men, and they have since 1980. But that doesn't mean that there are not huge numbers of women out there who still do not participate. And they have – single women are a, kind of a mixed bag of people, but they include many – but they include many of the groups who traditionally have not voted at high rates, including, for example – young women, I think, as Paige mentioned, you know, who vote traditionally very low rates. Also, women who are single heads of households, who are among the poorest of Americans. They're out there. They're not voting for the reasons that, that Paige mentioned, but they're also not voting because they're just struggling, literally struggling to, you know, to put food on the table and to keep their lives together. And they feel they aren't they're too busy to be informed about politics, and they feel that, you know, politics doesn't matter and that politicians aren't really listening to what their concerns are.
Paige, if I can go back to you for a moment. I think I'm remembering 1992, and I'm wondering if there were issues there that specifically spoke to women voters that somehow have dropped off the agenda in 2004.
What happened was, with particularly with single women and unmarried women, at, when the Clinton health care promise and plan did not happen.
That's what it was.
That there was a precipitous drop, because health care is one of the chief issues that these women care about, not only for themselves, but for their children and for their parents. I mean, that, I mean, they were disappointed in the process, and they don't think their voices were being heard. They think that, you know, politics and politicians are controlled by big interests, special interests, and big corporations, and they don't believe that they can have an impact. And yet, our survey and research data show, and our in discussions with these women, when they understand that there are 22 million unmarried women, women on their own, who did not participate in the process in 2000, who could have changed the debate in this country, who could have changed the agenda, that energizes them, and that motivates them to vote once they understand the power of their numbers.
Jack Beatty, I'd like you to bring you into the conversation at this point. What do you think is at work here with the this huge block of single women who don't vote?
Well, I think you can see it in the numbers. Vulnerable women, that is single white women, non-college, earning $30,000 or less, came out 18%, they made up 18% of the vote in 92 when health care for everyone, health care that's always there, was on the ballot. They were 15% in 96 when it really wasn't on the ballot. And they had sunk to 10% in 2000 when you had a Democrat running who basically began the campaign, Al Gore did, say, we can't afford it. We can't have health care for everybody. We're going to have to go at it piecemeal. So it seems to me that, that right there, there's a story. I mean, you know, when the Republican Party elected Abraham Lincoln, it ran on a slogan, vote yourself a tariff, vote yourself a homestead. And, you know, vote yourself medical care and vote yourself the deductibility of rent. I mean, no politician has talked about that since Jerry Brown years ago. And there must be millions of people, single women, for whom that is a big issue. Middle class folks get the deductibility of their mortgage interest. And yet it's never been applied to renters. If the Democrats can finally figure out a program that is right at the needs of people, this is the sort of thing it might be.
Paige, if I can return to you back again with that. One of the things that I did read that I thought was really interesting, and we talk about maybe not addressing issues for some of these voters, also, none of the candidates look like they do. Single women identify most with other single women.
It's very interesting that you bring that up. One of the most trusted messengers and people who single women want to hear from are women elected officials. Why? Because they think they've, you know, walked in their shoes, been there, done that,
right.
Understand it. And so that is one of the, as we get more and more women elected officials into the process, more and more women candidates, there is a sense that, you know, these women who are running for office do understand the lives of women on their own and do understand.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to pick it up again after the break. Thank you, Paige. We're talking tonight with Paige Gardner, co-founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote. Also joining me is Susan Carroll, professor of political science at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the vote of single women in the U.S. and their potential to shape this year's election. Here's a public service announcement produced by Women's Voices, Women Vote, meant to target this group.
I can't keep up. This is too hard.
Ask the politicians to take a few laps in our shoes.
Got laid off. They took my health insurance.
Maybe they'll get it.
What if I get sick? This is killing me.
And maybe they won't.
Just a bad dream. Glad that's over.
Don't you think it's time to elect people who understand what it's like in the real world for a single woman trying to stretch a shrinking paycheck? If you want change, change the way you think about voting.
That was a public service announcement produced by Women's Voices, Women Vote, a group trying to get single women to the polls. Why does it take such a special effort to get this group to vote? Why do you think traditional politics don't seem to reach unmarried women? Let us know. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Paige Gardner, co-founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote, and an expert in the voting patterns of women. Also with us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is Susan Carroll, professor of political science and senior scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Susan, if I can go back to you with something that Paige was just telling us about. Does having a woman in a political race change women's turnout? Can we document that?
We actually don't have statistics that would really show that, because it's so hard to get the turnout figures. But there certainly is lots of impressionistic evidence that that is the case, that women are more energized when there's a woman candidate in the race, and that they definitely are more likely to pay attention to the race, as Paige said, to feel that. When there's a woman in the race, that she has walked in their shoes, that she does, in fact, understand the problems that they face in their daily lives, and that adds a dimension that otherwise wouldn't be there.
How do you think that single women's concerns are actually reflected in the population at large? What we see right now is a lot of concern out there about security. What are we going to do about terrorism, the war in Iraq? Are these issues that speak to this voting bloc, do you think?
I actually think this particular voting bloc is more concerned with the economic issues. Mm. Although I do think you've got to disaggregate this voting bloc to some extent to really talk about.
I don't know what that word means. Disaggregate.
Okay. Yeah. To break it apart. To pull
Thank
it apart
you.
Because it really. I'm sorry. It really. There really are many different subgroups within the group single women. And if you take young women, for example, I do think the war is very much on the minds of younger voters and young women. And the abortion issue is also of concern to that particular group of women, and resonates with them in a way that it really doesn't with women who are older. Women who are some of the women who are in this block of single women are women who are widows. They tend to be older. They tend to be seniors. And they tend to be very concerned with the health care issue, certainly, mm-hmm. but also about retirement security, because they are facing, they have less money saved for retirement frequently. And so they're very concerned about those kinds of issues. So it really depends on and single heads of households, as I talked about before, are among the poorest voters. One quarter of them live of the women who are single heads of households. One quarter of them live below the poverty line. We know how low that figure is in American society.
Let me just – it's actually interesting. Yes, they do underregister. Women on their own do underregister and undervote. And yet, it is very important to note that they are 20% of the electorate now, which is equal to or slightly larger than African American, Hispanic, or Jewish voters combined. This is a huge portion of the electorate right now. However, they are 24% of the population overall, and yet 20% only of the electorate, versus married women who are 28% of the population, and yet 32% of the electorate. So even though this is the largest group of non-participants in our process, they do represent a substantial portion of our current electorate. These are the largest group of progressive agents of change that we have in this country. As you know, Susan was saying, they're pro-choice. They're concerned about retirement. Actually, most women on their own are concerned about retirement at a much younger age than married women or voters overall. So they understand what it's like to be in this country, to live on the edge, and they are enormous progressive agents of change.
Well, let's go to the phones now. We have a caller who speaks to this from personal experience. Melissa, you're calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So tell us your situation. Do you vote?
No, and it's sad because, you know, I've listened to your conversation and you do feel alone. You feel like these people don't know, you know, the struggles that you make every day. You know, I'm 27 years old and I've never voted simply for that reason. And, you know, you feel alone. You feel like these people don't know how important these issues are and what difference can I really make.
Yeah.
And you know, and I do the same thing. You know, I'm busy every day trying to stretch my dollar, and I make under the $30,000 a year, and it's very hard. But I have to say, listening to the conversations you've had tonight, it's encouraging to me to go out and vote, knowing how many people really are out there.
Are you Melissa, are you a single mom?
Yes, I am.
If there was an issue that was going to get you to the polls this November, can you name one?
It would probably be the health care.
Okay.
Definitely. You know, being a single parent, you know, I rely on that health care. You know, my little boy has medical problems, and it will make or break your lifestyle. I mean, I've gone in debt several times through, you know, the years that I've had my son trying to pay off those bills because of the poor health care.
Mm. Paige, if I can turn this to you, Melissa is such a reality check on this, isn't she? I mean, she just said in one line, you know, I'm so busy, none of this seems to specifically affect me. I'm not voting. How do you address that?
Well, I mean, I, again, you know, not speaking for Melissa, but, you know, she is one, literally, of 22 million other single women in this country whose chief, you know, concern is health care. You know, Melissa, if she expressed her voice, she could change the agenda of this country. She has the power with, you know, with other, you know, women like her to literally change the agenda of this country.
Mm.
And we, you know, this is a story that you hear frequently in focus groups, you know, in one-on-one conversations. Health care is such an important issue and so critical to the lives of women on their own. And they need, you know, and they can make their voices heard.
Well, and it's not an esoteric issue either. It's one it's dollars and cents, and it's obvious, and the results are clear. And, you know, for someone like Melissa, obviously a huge factor. Back to the phones now. Carolyn, you're calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Hi, my name's Caroline. Thanks for taking my call.
Caroline, it is.
Yes, hi. The reason I was calling is, I mean, very interesting show tonight. And I'm 43 years old, and I've been a nurse in Boston for 20 years. I live in New Hampshire. Basically, when I called and I was just speaking to whoever I was speaking with, I was explaining the situation. When I was younger and living in Boston after I graduated from college and was a new nurse, voting really wasn't in front of me. It wasn't something that was really important to me. Politics I wanted nothing to do with because I never trusted politicians. And I was renting footloose and fancy free, living in the city, not paying taxes on property, et cetera, et cetera. But now I'm 43 years old. I'm just going through a divorce. I'm almost finished with my divorce. Going through the Massachusetts court systems, I have been treated as a second-class citizen, as a woman. I've lost my home. I've lost so much through this divorce, which I'm going to take to Capitol Hill. I'm going to fight the fact that judges are very unfair, in my opinion, of women in the state of Massachusetts.
So if I've got you right here, you feel like you actually have more of a stake now in the outcome of politics. Okay.
Exactly, because now I'm older. I mean, obviously with age comes maturity. And we're faced, I mean, obviously being a nurse in Boston, working at Mass General, health is as you were just speaking about, health concerns are huge. Mm-hmm. Insurance, they're huge. And there are just so many factors. Abortion, just as you get older, these things are facing you. And going through, as I said, I still think that women are treated as second-class citizens, and I never, ever would have believed it until I started my divorce in the state of Massachusetts 10 months ago.
Okay, I'd like to turn this over, Caroline, to a comment from one of our guests. Paige, that age difference there about feeling like you have more of a stake in things as you grow older, what does it look like now for the young single woman voter? Are they not voting, or are they considered to be a voting bloc?
Actually, that's a very interesting point you raise, because if you look at the difference between unmarried women, single women, and married women who are young, there's really not that much of a difference in terms of their voting rates overall. The gap begins to grow astronomically as, you know, people age. And so there is a 16 in your 40s, you know, or at the beginning in the actually late 30s, early 40s, there becomes a 16-point gap between the rates of how married women vote and women on their own or unmarried women vote. And so young women overall do not vote, and that is something that this country absolutely needs to address. But the gap between, you know, single women not voting and married women voting really begins in the 30s and the 40s.
I'd like to bring in a couple new guests here at this point, broaden out the discussion a little bit. Two political specialists, each of whom works separately on this issue for the two political parties. Joining me from Washington is Celinda Lake, one of the Democrats' leading strategists. Welcome, Celinda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Joining me from New Jersey is Kellyanne Conway, president of the Republican consulting firm The Polling Company. Kellyanne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If I can start with you, Celinda, what is the Democratic strategy for reaching out to single women? They sure do seem to be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, they are, and we've been fortunate enough to get to work with our neutral hat on with Paige on this project. Well, I think that most of the campaigns have in their state-coordinated plans reaching out to unmarried women and doing aggressive targeting in terms of GOTV. Also, as Paige probably mentioned, there are a number of nonpartisan groups, Planned Parenthood, U.S. Action, and in a number of our labor unions, a number of our women candidates who independently have built into their efforts reaching out to unmarried women and are building on long-term issue relations with them with mail and phones and cable television and door-to-door canvassing to get them out to vote.
Okay, so those are who and those are how. Do you have any sense that you're actually reaching people?
Yes. In fact, Planned Parenthood, for example, has been quite successful and has measured the success by having them sign a petition as a way of kind of interim commitment in support of Planned Parenthood. And they've gotten thousands of these women in a number of states to sign the petitions. There are a number of organizations, including U.S. Action and MOB, who have registered thousands as well. So I think there is some success.
Kellyanne Conway, if I can turn to you, what type of single woman voter is the Republican Party after in this election?
Well, we're likely to target those single women who are actually stakeholders or want to be stakeholders in the overall system in what has become a true full-blown ownership society that has been able to progress beyond one race or beyond one gender, beyond one age cohort. We recognize that single women are remaining single more through choice than through circumstance these days. And so they don't feel the need to wait for a man in their life until they buy their first home, until they start investing in the stock market and through 401k plans or portfolios. And they become more, as they become more vested in the system, as they take on mortgages and mutual funds, if not marriage and munchkins, they do seem to ascribe to a more Republican-leaning philosophy. And I, you know, despite what Planned Parenthood is doing and what some of perhaps of the pro-life groups are doing on my side, if the reach for single women is going to be centered mainly on abortion, they're probably going to be missed altogether, because that's been a tremendous misperception about this group of unmarried women, that somehow they're motivated only by abortion or only by gun control. And what we're finding is they have such a broader, more inclusive panoply of issues that motivate them. They're more likely to talk about health care, for example, and the entire security and affordability themes.
Yeah, can I interrupt you there, Kellyanne, and ask you a specific question, though? When you talk about women worried about, you know, mortgages and mutual funds and whatnot, that does sound to me like you're targeting a specific group in that single women voters block, because one of our callers, Melissa, we just spoke to, isn't worried about mortgages and mutual funds. She's making under $30,000 a year. So are you talking about more of a, yes, a single woman, but making a little more money? That's who the Republicans are going after.
Who the Republicans are targeting, I can assure you that they're leaving no voter group, including single women with lower incomes, uncovered and untouched this year, mainly because we feel that, number one, the elections are showing that there are very progressive demographic groups that are not aligned so strictly with one party or the other anymore, that they're more up for grabs. And number two, we're finding that because women tend to be, undecided voters tend to be about two-thirds female these days, we would have expected them to be firmly in the Kerry camp. And some of these lower-income women who are not yet in the Kerry camp, one has to wonder why that is and why they're up for grabs. So we feel pretty bold that as the incumbent, we can probably reach out to them in a strategy that appeals to them. That's why I mentioned health care and I mentioned the whole security and affordability themes.
Okay. I'd like to put a question to Celinda there. Do you think that you have in the Democratic Party more of a chance of winning the single women's vote simply because women historically have tended to vote more Democrat than Republican?
Oh, I think we're guaranteed to win it.
Careful.
I mean, in the sense that, unmarried women, particularly unmarried women under 55, aren't voting just a little bit Democratic. They're voting, they've historically voted solidly Democratic. I mean, they're virtually a core constituency. And I think that's why we feel it's really important to get them out. But I think that Kellyanne has made two good points, and that is these women are very economically oriented, very focused on health care, but that's where the Democrats have a strong message to them as well. I mean, we're the ones who have a plan to ensure people to get health care costs down. And the Opportunity Society is basically saying, yes, you have an opportunity, but you're on your own. And these women say, hey, sometimes government has a role here in helping people when they get in a hard spot.
I think we're going to have to leave it at that at this point in the program, Celinda. But thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Celinda Lake is a Democratic strategist and a pollster with Lake, Snell, Perry & Associates. Kellyanne, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Kellyanne Conway, a Republican strategist, president of The Polling Company. We're discussing the power of single women as a voting bloc. Do you think Democrats and Republicans have an equal shot with single women? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about political efforts to reach out to single women. We're joined tonight by Paige Gardner, co-founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote, and an expert in the voting patterns of women. With us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, is Susan Carroll, professor of political science and a senior scholar at Rutgers University. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. We also have a lot of calls, so I'd like to go back to the phones. Amy, you're calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I called because I'm a single mom, and I vote all the time, but I think I can understand where the women who aren't voting are coming from. If you think about it, the opposite of a single woman is a married man, and that's two of the implied requirements for being a president. So when you're talking about voting for the presidential race, I mean, you couldn't really have anybody who, represents you less. I think, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And also like a military history. I mean, there's all these ways that you are a second-class citizen, as Caroline said earlier, the earlier caller, that this doesn't speak to you on a very basic level, that as soon as you are divorced or separated or never got married in the first place, I mean, there's sort of this romantic idea that any child born in America can become president someday. Mm. And that's just not the reality.
Not so far.
And I think, I mean, you know, women understand this. I also wonder what the socioeconomic breakdown would be of that sample of women who aren't voting, because there are very real things that I think that Republican who was on earlier just was so out of touch with. I mean, to get to the polls, if you're not a working woman, if you're a single mom on welfare, because it simply would cost more to get child care, for example, mm-hmm. than you would ever hope to bring in working, you're talking about getting all of your children together to get to a poll. You probably can't afford a car. I mean, I live in a sort of a lower, economic background.
Lower income.
Lower income neighborhood. Thank you. And, I mean, they bus to the grocery store, or they cab to the grocery store, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And getting all of your children, and there's nap times, and there's making meals. And I think there's this just typical voting pattern, which is someone on their way to work in the morning gets out of their car, goes to the, you know, 5 minutes, or on the way home from work, again,
We're starting to lose you there, Amy. You're breaking up on the cell phone. Paige, can I turn that to you for a moment? These are very practical realities about why some women might not get to the polls.
She's exactly right. They're busy. They're worried about, you know, from paycheck to paycheck. That is why, you know, one of the things that Women's Voices, Women Vote is trying to do is a systematic effort to do, for the first time in really our history, to reach out to women on their own very aggressively through vote by mail, through early vote.
Why don't you just get some of them a bus?
Well, and that would be a great idea. But you know what? The point is here is to make it easy to vote, to get rid of the barriers to voting. And so there are a variety of things that we're trying to do to say, we understand your lives are busy. We understand you're exhausted, really. And while you think it's important to vote, we haven't made it easy for you to vote. And so we are reaching out systematically with a lot of other organizations to say, we care about your vote.
I'd like to go back to the phones here. We have a man on the phones. Bob, you're calling from Deerfield, Illinois. Welcome to One Point. Are you there, Bob? Oh, Bob disappeared, and I'm sorry to lose him. If I can bring Susan Carroll into the discussion. Susan, when we look at some of these practical realities, the difficulties for women, I'm wondering if there are any, draws maybe by not the fact that any of the candidates are female, but the candidates' wives. I'm looking at a person like Teresa Carey, for example, and whether that might have any sort of draw for single women voters, even though she's not actually a candidate?
Well, I certainly think it can have some impact, but I really think that women are going to look to the presidential candidates, the men who are running, and look at their issue positions and what they're standing for, and that's really going to be the major determining factor. And I would say that, you know, to the various groups who are registering single women, I think what's really important, I think the last caller really illustrated this, that it's very important not only to make sure that these various groups of single women get registered, but also that there are efforts and underway to make sure that they get to the polls and are able to get to the polls, and that the organizations work to get to the polls. And I think that's going to make a big difference in terms of providing, as you said, providing buses, transportation, easy access to voting, child care, people who will go and take care of their children while they vote, so that it does really make it possible for these women to vote the first time, and people who will go to the polls with them and assist them and show them how to vote.
Yeah,
because that too can be an intimidating, it can be an intimidating thing to vote the first time. So, what I would suggest too is that if there are women out there in the listening audience who are thinking about voting for the first time, to the extent you can, go with a friend. It's much easier if you do it together. You know, there's power in numbers. You feel you can make it into a, you know, it can be fun to do. You'll feel more secure about doing it. It will not be nearly as, it's not a frightening thing, but it can certainly seem frightening the first time.
The buddy system.
Yes, the buddy system, I think, is a really good strategy.
Jack Beatty, I'd like to turn the last comment over to you.
Well, this is a period of party parity. Very unusual in American politics. We've had it in the 19th century. Someone has got to break it. There's got to be a realignment. Here you have 22 million voters out there, and the party that can speak to them, a large part of them, could break the parity. Now, John Kerry has a program that basically says he will insure 26 million people on one side versus George Bush's tax cut for people earning $200,000 or more. That's the choice. You want the 26 million insured for Kerry. You want the tax cuts for the 200,000, vote for Bush. He also favors raising the minimum wage. No single act of Kerry's would do more to help this most vulnerable group. Bush will not raise the minimum wage, and as governor of Texas, he vetoed 7 minimum wage increases for agricultural workers. Kerry favors an expansion of the earned income tax credit, which would boost the wages of people who are in the workforce now. And above all, Kerry favors dues check, which is a bill that's in the House of Representatives today that essentially would make it easier to organize unions, than which nothing could be more important to the living standards of single women in the country.
Paige Gardner, I think that you have to thank Jack Beatty for that. Are you there?
Yes, I am, and I would agree.
Well, those are just factual statements.
No, I mean, that is correct.
Fair enough, Jack.
That's what the program is.
I'm just pulling your leg, Jack. Thank you all for joining us tonight. We're going to have to end the conversation there. Thank you, Paige Gardner.
Thank you.
Paige Gardner is co-founder of Women's Voices, Women Vote, and an expert in the voting patterns of women. Susan Carroll, thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Susan Carroll is professor of political science and senior scholar at Rutgers University Center for American Women and Politics. And, of course, Jack, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty is On Point's news analyst. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, another Army report on the Abu Ghraib prison scandal is released, and this one names names. This is On Point. The second report in 2 days on the Abu Ghraib prison scandal was released today, and it was damning. The Army's Fay report found evidence of torture and said 23 military intelligence and 4 civilian contractors working with them were directly involved in the abuses. The report comes a day after a separate independent panel released a report blaming senior leaders, including Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld and Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard Myers, for lax oversight and inattention to the issue of military-run prisons in Iraq. Michael Hirsch is senior editor for Newsweek magazine and has been one of the lead reporters on the Abu Ghraib scandal. He joins us now from Washington. Hello again, Michael.
Hello, Jennifer.
What's new about the Fay report when we compare it to yesterday's Schlesinger's report?
Well, this is much more focused specifically on military intelligence. It was intended that way. And as you suggested at the outset, it does name names, gets into specifics in a way that the Schlesinger Commission report was never designed to do. And it's, I think, very striking in that respect.
One of the things the report also does is cite some pretty human failings, moral corruption, lack of discipline, lack of leadership as primary reasons for the abuses. And I'm wondering if this translates in any hard way to how the military operates and trains, or is it just a way of removing blame from the Army as an institution, do you think?
Well, the Army has been rocked by these scandals. There's no question about it. I was just out at Fort Huachuca in Arizona a couple weeks ago, which is the Army training center for interrogators, and I can tell you that You know, they have really taken the implications of this scandal on board. They, you know, it's informed their instructions. There's no question that new trainees, everyone who enters the Army now is reminded of their core values in a way, and you know, with perhaps an emphasis that was never, that was not seen before. So there's no question that this has had a lot of impact. And I think that the implications of this report that came out today, when it's fully digested, are gonna have an even more powerful impact, because up until now, the administration has continued to say that basically it's seven military police bad guys, bad people who misbehaved. And that's something that the Schlesinger Commission really emphasized. But what this report makes clear is that military intelligence was involved in these 27 cases that go beyond the photographs. And, of course, this is exactly what some of the defendants in the court-martial are themselves saying, namely the military police, that they were encouraged in these abuses. And so that this really, I think, indicates that this was indeed a much more systemic problem.
Soften them up for interrogation later. How far up the military intelligence food chain does the report take the blame?
It's going to be interesting to see. The report, I mean, they do specifically name people up to the level of the commander of the 205th Military Intelligence Brigade, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Pappas. There's a very good chance, I think, at this point that he will be court-martialed. General Kern at the news conference today announcing this report indicated that he might well be. General Sanchez, the head of Joint Task Force 7, himself comes in for some criticism. I think it's important, though, to maintain the difference, as General Kern said today, between culpability and responsibility. Culpability, people up to Lieutenant Colonel Pappas's level may actually find themselves with, facing criminal charges. I don't think anyone else higher than that will. However, careers like Sanchez's may be ruined. You know, I think even higher than that, people in the senior civilians in the Pentagon up to Defense Secretary Rumsfeld are going to find themselves on the defensive to the end of their tenures over this.
We talked a bit before on the Schlesinger report about the fact that it was done at least at one hand removed from the actual military. That's not the case with this report. It is an internally generated document. But it sounds to me like you're saying that it lay a lot of blame around. I mean, is there any reason to suspect the report because the military conducted it itself?
No, I mean, I think, you know, this is a much more of a standard type of operating procedure. The Army is a huge organization. It can and must be expected to investigate itself. That's the whole idea behind courts martial, is that, it is a military service investigating itself. The controversy over this report, one of the reasons it was delayed, is that initially a two-star general, General Fay, was placed in charge of it by Sanchez himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, as allegations rose to higher levels in the Abu Ghraib scandal, it became clear that Sanchez himself might be implicated. And so the Army then directed a higher-ranking general to take over the investigation because of the possibility that Sanchez himself might be somehow implicated, at least in terms of responsibility, as indeed he was in the final report.
Right, and be a bit of a conflict. Just briefly here, Michael, we've had two investigative reports within the last 2 days. What's next?
Well, there's going to be hearings in the fall by the Senate Armed Services Committee about all of these reports, the Schlesinger Commission report, this one, another one that's coming out for the Admiral Church, looking into Guantanamo Bay and into Abu Ghraib. And then we will have to see whether there's an increasing pressure on any senior civilians up to Rumsfeld to resign.
After these. Yeah. So we're going to have to leave it at that, Michael, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Hirsch is senior editor for Newsweek magazine. He spoke to me from Washington. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.